Gaza or slams the West for falsehood and hypocrisy. Its ongoing Gaza genocide condemns the U.S. for repeatedly vetoing UN resolutions to stop Palestinian bloodshed. As the U.S.-Israel genocide in Gaza enters its 141st day, the killing and destruction campaign against Palestinians continues with a death toll nearing 30,000. And on the second anniversary of the ongoing Ukraine-Russia war, Moscow attributes prolonged conflict to Western financial and military support for Kiev. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has lashed out at Western hypocrisy on the U.S.-managed Israeli campaign of genocide in Gaza. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says it has become evident that the West's claims on human rights are lies. He noted Western governments kick up a fuss over the execution of a criminal while turning a blind eye to the killing of some 30,000 innocent people in Gaza. The leader said that the U.S. has flagrantly and for multiple times vetoed UN Security Council resolutions on ending Israeli bombardments of Gaza. Ayatollah Khamenei said this is the true colors of Western civilization and liberal democracy, which embody politicians who have smiles on their faces but are actually, quote, rabid dogs and bloodthirsty wolves within. Now Gaza is reeling from Israel's genocidal campaign, with several areas of the besieged territory witnessing fresh airstrikes. Regime helicopters bombed southern areas of Deir al-Balah, a city in central Gaza. Israeli warplanes also pounded a town near the southern city of Khan Yunis. City's Al-Nasser Hospital is still under Israeli siege. According to Doctors Without Borders, Israeli forces are not allowing the evacuation of patients from hospital buildings to transfer them elsewhere for treatment. Other hospitals throughout Gaza are either out of service or operating under dire conditions. A Palestinian child has died from starvation at Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza is now in its fifth month. Over 29,600 Palestinians have so far been killed, most of them women and children. Israeli forces have launched new airstrikes against the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah. City houses nearly 1.5 million people that have been displaced from across the besieged strip, and it's a zone that the Israelis had declared safe by the regime. So let's listen to some Palestinian accounts about their plight after the latest Israeli airstrike.
Every day, there are 50 martyrs in the safe areas, or 100 martyrs. Every day, 20 to 30 houses or 30 buildings are destroyed. This is an international conspiracy against us. This is what they want. Every day there are 30, 50, or 100 killed, numbers like that. Why then would they want a ceasefire? We are dying little by little. We have more than 100,000 martyrs and wounded. Even if the Israelis leave us, more than 200,000 or 300,000 people will die from the exposure to gases and toxic fumes from the bombardments. This is how we will die. Those American weapons that are donated to Israel, we have never seen anything like this. Israeli rockets are targeting children, homes, and places housing innocent, simple civilians.
There is no safe place in Gaza. They said Rafah was a safe place. Look and show people how safe it is. They dropped barrels of bombs on innocent people in their sleep. They were innocent children. They were left under the rubble last night.
We were sleeping in our house when we heard the sound of a missile. The noise was very loud, and as you can see, it caused a significant amount of damage. We rushed to the site and found people martyred and injured. This is humiliating. As you can see, this two-story house was completely erased. This was an annihilation missile, not a normal missile. Rafah is supposed to be safe, but nowhere is left safe. The places they said were safe are targeted with missiles. There's no safety.
And there's no end in sight to Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces have carried out fresh incursions into several areas of the occupied territories, abducting a number of Palestinians. Earlier, our correspondent in occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us with some details.
The Israelis raided after midnight the village of Azzoun near Qalqilia. The Israelis have also stormed several areas in Jenin. The Israelis stormed Faqua village, Arbuna in Jenin, as well as in Qalqilia. The Israeli forces stormed Al Marj area, Al Naqar neighborhood, and Al-Kabir school area. The Israelis, as we have received from the citizens there, the Israeli forces stormed the citizens' home, and they caused severe damage in their properties. A number of Palestinians had been detained in these areas, but the exact numbers are still unknown, according to the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs and Palestinian Prisoners Society. On Thursday, issued their latest statement saying that the Israelis have detained over 7,100 Palestinians since the 7th of October. The Israelis had also stormed Al-Janazon refugee camp, northern Ramallah, and exchange of fire have taken place between Palestinians there in Al-Janazon area and the Israeli forces. Palestinian paramedics said that at least two Palestinians had been wounded during the Israeli military raid to Al-Janazon.
A senior Hamas official has lambasted the Israeli Prime Minister's plan for a future of Gaza, saying Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking to fragment Palestinian land.
Netanyahu presents a piece of paper containing his repeated ideas, but in reality this paper has no basis or reflects any practicality, because these are Palestinians and Gazans who would actually determine their fate and any future course of actions. The Israeli Prime Minister is adamant on the separation of the West Bank and Gaza, as well as the separation of Al-Quds from the West Bank. This means that the actual plan of this entity is to take over and fragment Palestinian lands and not allow the Palestinians to determine their fate themselves.
Hamdan also said that Palestinians should be allowed to control their own destiny, adding the international community is responsible in this regard. On Thursday, the Israeli premier presented the regime's war cabinet with a post-war Gaza plan. That proposal suggests Israel will keep security control on Palestinian areas, including the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinian authorities also reacted to the regime's so-called plan, saying it amounts to the imposition of Israeli control over the besieged territory. It says Gaza will only be part of an independent Palestinian state. The Israeli regime says it's targeted Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon in response to rocket fire on a settlement in occupied Palestine. There's been no immediate reports of casualties or damage from the latest Israeli strikes, but earlier Israeli media reported that two Hezbollah rockets struck Adamit, a city in the western Galilee region inside occupied territories. Tensions between Israel and Hezbollah have been on the rise since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza, citing Al-Aqsa flood operation by the Hamas resistance movement. Over the past 4 months, Hezbollah has conducted several attacks on Israeli bases and facilities in occupied territories, but the Israeli army recently also hit residential areas in southern Lebanon, killing a number of civilians. Now, February 24th marks the second anniversary of the start of the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Western leaders, including the EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, are visiting Kyiv to extend their support for Ukrainian authorities. The 2 years of armed conflict has caused human and material losses for both sides, but Russian forces have been able to capture several eastern Ukrainian regions. Kyiv and Moscow failed, though, to reach agreements in the past negotiations on several issues, including a prisoner swap and allowing Ukraine's grain shipments. Meanwhile, the Russian ambassador to the UN says a Western backing for Ukraine has prolonged the war.
Any conflict ends sooner or later. There is no doubt that the Ukrainian conflict will end as well. There is no doubt that the longer it lasts, due to the sustained support by the West, the less advantageous peace conditions will be for Ukraine.
The Russian envoy urged the West to engage in meaningful dialogue where the interests of all countries will be guaranteed. This comes as the U.S. has already provided Kyiv with tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons and financial aid. The U.S. President Joe Biden is seeking a congressional approval of another $60 billion aid package. Moscow has warned time and again Western military and financial support for Ukraine is an impediment to any possible settlement of the conflict. And now joining us for more on the story is Greg Simons, independent researcher and author, joining us from Uppsala. Hello, Mr. Simons, pleasure to have you on the program. Sir, your thoughts about 2 years plus of conflict between these two neighbors and a Western hand that's in it, and how much that, according to the Russians, has been an impediment to reaching some kind of consensus on putting a stop to it?
Well, I mean, if we look at the whole thing and why it started, it is seriously misrepresented by the US-led West. They say this is about Russia wanting to recreate the Soviet Union or something like this, that it's an unprovoked war, that it's a full-scale war, or all that this propaganda and slogans. But if you look at it, I mean, they already revealed before the war started why the US wanted to provoke Russia into going into war. And this was, they wanted to use Ukraine as another Afghanistan against Russia. In other words, to use it to weaken and contain Russia. And this has failed. And the West, the US and its vassal states like the EU and so forth, have been supplying weapons, have been supplying money, they've been supplying intelligence, they've even been supplying men on the ground, although this is, of course, covert. So there is this still desire. I mean, you can see it on these US politicians. This is the best money we've spent, killing Russians and no US soldiers die. This is purely US geopolitics at its very worst, where Ukraine is the meat and the grinder. And of course, you cannot trust the US. I mean, they do not keep their word. This has been proven again and again. So Russia is in a quandary with this war. I mean, obviously Ukraine is not the one to negotiate with, the US is, but they're unreliable, and their intent is very much aimed against Russia and Russian interests. So it's an impasse at the moment, although militarily speaking, Russia has the upper hand now.
Right, and Mr. Simons, I mean, it seems like Russia is not going to back down from its demand that it refuses to have NATO parked on its doorstep. So with that being the case, I mean, how far do you see this thing protracting? I mean, how do you see a conclusion to this war?
The conclusion needs to be political in the end. This war is hurting Europe, which is being deindustrialized because of what the US is doing there. The US is going into a presidential election in November, and I mean, with the US having two unpopular wars, I mean, Ukraine being the lesser of the unpopular war, the more unpopular one being Gaza, the Democrats are likely to lose if they continue these wars. So, I mean, until November, I mean, it's going to be too late if they withdraw from the wars in November. And to withdraw from the war is simply to leave Ukraine to its own devices. So, in other words, if we look at this as an example from history, I mean, they did the same thing to Iraq after it failed to destroy Iran in the war there. So, I mean, you have a similar scenario, what happens to Ukraine when the political will evaporates because the political costs of continuing the war are too much, and for Europe, the economic costs, and you're having a lot of different protests and social unrest because of the incompetence of these vassals, which are not...
Greg, we don't have a lot of time. I want to get this... we have less than a minute left. If you can answer this third question. You mentioned elections. I'm glad, because that's part of my final question for you. Post-U.S. elections, a lot of people say it really looks like the Republicans are going to come back into the Oval Office. How does that impact this war?
Well, I mean, this is going to depend on who enters. I mean, Trump says he wants to come to some agreement with Russia. I mean, he said that last time too, and then you had Russiagate. But the problem is that it becomes much less predictable because there is not an appetite for these endless wars. And if Trump does come back, he'll be more experienced and more able and capable of asserting what he wants than he was the first time.
Okay, stay safe. Thanks for having us or spending some time with us here in our bulletin. From Uppsala, Greg Simons, independent researcher and author there joining us. Meanwhile, support for Palestinians continues throughout various sectors. In Pakistan, students from religious educational institutions have been holding demonstrations denouncing Israel's atrocities in Gaza. Pakistani healthcare workers have also announced that they're willing and ready to provide voluntary services to the wounded people of Gaza. Our correspondent, Nasir Kazemi, reports.
Students from seminaries and religious schools gathered in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad to protest against what they termed as Israeli barbarism in the Gaza Strip. The demonstration, organized by various student organizations, saw impassioned speeches, chants, and calls for immediate international intervention to halt the violence in Gaza.
We cannot remain silent while innocent lives are being lost in Gaza. The world must hold Israel accountable for its crimes and work towards immediate ceasefire.
The protesters also criticized the international community for what they perceived as a lack of meaningful intervention to address the situation in Gaza.
We stand with our brothers and sisters in Gaza, and we will continue to raise our voices against oppression and injustice. It is time for the world to wake up and take action to end the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Meanwhile, in a display of solidarity and as a humanitarian gesture, Pakistani health professionals, including doctors, surgeons, and paramedics, have stepped forward to offer their voluntary services to assist the tens of thousands of wounded people in Gaza who are facing severe hardships in Palestinian hospitals.
I would love to go to Gaza if there is some arrangement from the government of Pakistan. I would love to volunteer myself that I want to go there. I want to serve the people of Palestine and to serve the injured, to serve the kids, to serve the old people and the women to whom they are killing, to whom they are bombing.
The announcement by the paramedic staff comes at a critical juncture in the Gaza crisis, as Israeli attacks claim more innocent Palestinian lives.
The Pakistani nation is actively supporting the people of Gaza through various means, including social media engagement, product boycotts, art exhibitions, seminars, and protest rallies. These efforts aim to spotlight Israel's ongoing atrocities in Palestine and draw global attention to the crisis. Nasir Kazemi, Islamabad.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Aperture.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
Such as gold.
Kingai.
Kingo.
Gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the Kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor, It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Five 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Pezat, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Pezat was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500, well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a thousand year coin, if you like.
The Pezat was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Pezat is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Pezat survived for 1,000 years. The Pezat was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you're a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins, backed by the government, played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bocho and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population, which had been devastated by the plague, was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum, my dear friends and folk from all around the world. Welcome back to IRB English Radio and thank you for joining us in a brand new episode of For a Better Life. This is Asma and I am more than happy to be sharing today's words with you. Well, as always, I have to mention this very point that in For a Better Life, we're talking about issues and topics that are related for the betterment of human beings. I'm not a scholar. We tend to talk about issues that might work like a trigger to our thoughts and to our life in a way that it could make us go and know more about those issues and topics. Well, as for today, in For a Better Life, we're going to talk about something very much prevailing and common to every single one of us. I believe that there is no single person, an individual in this world who could claim that I have never been through a phase of anger, and I have never been an angry person. I have never shouted at anyone out of anger, because this is going to be a big fat lie. As human beings, I do believe that sometimes we just go through some moments in which controlling ourselves is a very difficult task. Like, for example, when you expect something to happen according to what you have planned for it, but it does not. Once you expect someone to be exactly the way you wanted them to be or expected them to be, but they are not. Like once, when you wish for something to happen, but it does not happen, though you have tried so hard for it. All of these moments that are very much common in every single, in every one of our lives, in these moments we get angry. Like many of us do not know how to control this anger. And for those who know, it's not always the case that they could control their anger. Because I usually think of controlling anger as a talent and as a skill that we have to acquire it by time. As we grow older, we come to learn that sometimes in life, anger is inevitable. We go through it. We're going to face it no matter how much we're going to control it. But there is one day after all that we're going to shout it out loud. That, okay, I'm angry because of this, because of that, because of everything that are not going according to my wishes. So in the narrations of Islam and in our Islamic heritage, we have a lot of teachings that tell us controlling your anger has got a lot of rewards. Now, aside from the rewards, being a perfect personality who could control their anger, who could control the things that happen to them, the things that would agitate them, is a thing that would add to your worth and value. Is it easy? No. Do I have to do it? Of course, yes. Because, you know, we are social human beings, and we're social creatures, and we have to have interaction with other peoples. And if we are going to have a healthy, fruitful relationship with people in society, and if we are going to improve our personality and character, we have to learn some skills in order to control our anger, to not to go through a phase of agitation for too long in order to affect us in a bad way, not to go through a long phase of agitation in order to stay a calm personality who has got this skill to control themselves. So in order to achieve that, we have to learn some skills. And those skills are going to come after the break. Thank you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need, all I need, all I need, all I need, oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh.
All I need,
all
I need,
and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Is your love is all I need, to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Welcome back. Well, this is For a Better Life. You're listening to IRB English Radio. I am Asma, and we're talking about anger. As I always say it, in For a Better Life, we go through different topics that are going to help us improve ourselves, because everybody has got a definition of a better life. Some people see it in a materialistic perspective, which is a part of life, of course. But then some others might focus on the metaphysical part, on the part that is not evaluated through the materialistic achievement in life. One of the ways that is going to improve my personality and my character, and it's going to lead to the betterment of my perspective towards life and whatever, is to control my anger. Because just as I control my anger, I'm going to see things in a larger scale. I'm going to give other people a chance to have a overlook on whatever they're doing or saying. I'm going to actually give myself a chance to improve, to have more of patience. Well, this controlling of anger has got a direct relationship with patience. As we have it in the Holy Book of Quran, patience is one of the very difficult things to be practiced. And it's going to be done only by those people who are afraid of the day of the judgment. And when we say afraid, we mean that they have this consideration of the day of judgment, in which every single person is going to stand in front of God and then is going to be asked about every single thing they have done. So, undoubtedly, there's no one who would love to be, embarrassed in front of everybody. And by everybody, we do not mean the simple, ordinary people that we were living with in this world. No, all the prophets, all the great people, and aside from them, we have God. When you are standing in front of your Lord and you are going to be embarrassed in front of him, I guess nothing could be compared to the bitterness of that moment. When we say fear of the day of judgment, we mean that embarrassment, the bitterness of that moment that is going to happen in front of God while he's going to ask me for every single action I have made in this world. So, patience is difficult to be practiced. We need patience to control our anger. But as I just said, it's not an easy task. We have to go through too much of, obstacles. We have to go through too much of practice and too much of experiences in order to improve ourselves in this skill. So, we have it from Imam Musa al-Kadhim that, as his name actually connotes to us, we have to just rein it in. We have to control our anger. There are a lot of stories related to anger and the Islamic heritage, but the most important one is just like the ones that come from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Like every time everybody addressed them, like every time anyone addressed them with this intention of anger or words that are so bitter and so cruel, they never fought back with them. They never answered those words with some much more bitter words, just as we do in normal, ordinary life. Like, if I get angry, there's a big chance for me to say things I don't really mean to say. But Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam used to rein it in, used to control it. As they always tell us, to control our anger, because sometimes in anger you're going to say things you don't mean, and then what happens is regret, and then after regret there is a great chance for you not being able to turn it back all around. Because once a heart is broken, once a word is said out loud, you cannot just take it back. You cannot bring that heart back to the first moment before the breakage, and then you cannot take back that word once it is uttered. So this was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for staying with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every cloud.
share, he knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader slams the West.